I was really alarmed that he actually contacted me out of the blue, but it just spoke to how big of an issue this is.
A diverse group of Alaskans promote a fix to the state budget. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, January 26th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, are there any signs in Alaska's economy of $30 a barrel oil?
If I just looked at total employment, total income, those big, big numbers, it would be hard to find.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Your household income and the size of your family might qualify you for savings on your health care costs. You have until Sunday, January 31st, to enroll in the Health Insurance Marketplace. Call 1-844-PLANS-AK. That's 1-844-752-6725 to find local assistance in your area. There's more information online at getcoveredalaska.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Primary Care Association.
An unlikely coalition of Alaskans, ranging from business and union leaders to Alaska Native corporations and past politicians, are launching the Alaska's Future campaign. The initiative is promoting long-term solutions to the state's fiscal crisis. And as APRN's Josh Edge reports, the group says the permanent fund needs to play a crucial role.
GCI CEO and Alaska's Future co-chair Ron Duncan says the state's $3.5 billion plus budget deficit is a problem that needs solving sooner rather than later.
What I concluded was that if the legislature leaves Juneau this year without fixing at least half the problem, that we'll have to stop investing.
Duncan says GCI has plans to spend more than $220 million building capital facilities in the next year, which would bring high-speed broadband internet to over a dozen new villages. But if lawmakers don't fix the fiscal crisis, Alaska could be facing a dramatic population drop, which he estimates to be pushing 25%. In that scenario, he predicts crashing property values and limited state services. He says that could affect whether GCI and other private sector businesses invest in the state.
When we and other private investors stop investing, you'll have a recession triggered by the private sector. And anybody who can look ahead is going to understand that you can't continue to expand, to put new capital in, to hire new people when the economy is on the verge of collapse.
Duncan says all paths to bridging the budget gap appear to point towards using some portion of the permanent fund earnings reserve. But touching the fund is generally viewed as politically unpopular.
Since that seems to be the largest single political impediment to getting the problem solved, that we should try to build an extremely broad-based coalition to say it's okay to use the permanent fund. So I started with the people that would be least likely to agree with me on any other issue.
One of those people was Vince Beltrami, president of the Alaska AFL-CIO labor union organization. Beltrami's first job with the IBEW was as an organizer, where he attempted to unionize a large group of Ron Duncan's employees.
I was really alarmed that he actually contacted me out of the blue, but it just spoke to how big of an issue this is.
Beltrami says there's only one major piece of legislation that is key to solving the state's budget issues, one tapping the permanent fund's earnings reserves. If it's not passed, he says once the state's budget reserves are depleted, the permanent fund could be gone shortly thereafter.
I'm worried not only for the workers that I represent in the state of Alaska, for their jobs and our home values and the future, but that we have a strong economy where our children, our grandchildren will benefit and will also have the same opportunity that we've had educationally, economically in the state, and that they'll also be able to continue to receive a permanent fund dividend into the future.
So, essentially, the group says the state needs to tap into the dividend in order to save it. NANA President Helvi Sandvik says that sustainability, along with a strong state economy, is especially important in rural areas where there are few private sector jobs and residents rely heavily on state services.
In rural Alaska, I see friends and family pooling their money so that they can afford maybe to buy a snow machine, so that they can go out and go hunting, can maybe afford to buy an outboard motor so they can afford to go fishing. So So those PFDs really make a meaningful contribution.
Aside from GCI, union groups, and NANA, the Alaska's Future Coalition has other supporters like Siri and former Governor Tony Knowles, among others. Anchorage Democratic Representative Les Guerra says he welcomes all ideas when it comes to fixing Alaska's fiscal problems, but he questions the group's hiring of two national conservative campaign workers, Michael Dubke and Ben Sparks. Sparks, the group's executive director, helped elect Dan Sullivan to the U.S. Senate. Guerra is concerned the partisan past of both men could undermine a collaborative political process in the legislature.
These guys are going to say that they're not going to work on campaigns, but if you look at the resume, everything they've ever done is to use millionaire and corporate money to attack people in campaigns. That's their talent. So it's really very curious why anybody thinks they have anything to lend in terms of helping us understand our fiscal problem.
And Guerra says the permanent fund is only part of the solution to that fiscal problem. That is a point GCI's Ron Duncan agrees with.
The permanent fund only solves the first step of the problem. That fills at most $2 billion of what, by the time the session ends, will be a $4 billion gap. We need targeted cuts. We need new revenue measures. We need to do other things as well. But if we don't do the permanent fund first, we might as well not worry about those other things because they don't make any difference.
Duncan says the group is not pushing for any one piece of legislation over another as long as the legislature ultimately takes steps to correct Alaska's fiscal crisis. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
As oil prices have dropped to levels that were unthinkable a year ago, many Alaskans are wondering whether the state is facing economic calamity. The short answer is not yet. Last year, the state added jobs despite plunging oil prices. In its annual forecast out this month, the Alaska Department of Labor predicts modest job losses in the year ahead. Those losses are expected to be concentrated in the oil and gas industry, in state government, and in the construction industry. If the forecast is right, it will be the first net job loss the state has seen since 2009, but the department anticipates the decline will be less than 1%. APRN's Rachel Waldholt sat down with state labor economist Neil Fried to ask how it's possible that at $30 a barrel, Alaska is still doing pretty well.
When we look at oil industry employment for 2015, we started out the year quite strong. In other words, employment numbers at the first part of 2015 were the highest they'd ever been. And by the time we got to the end of last year, that we had started to see, we started to lose ground compared to 2015. So we saw that trend happen. And we saw that with state government as well. A little different. It started out slightly negative in 2015. And as the year went by, you know, by time the third quarter was over, we started seeing numbers that were 1,000 or more lower than they were the previous year. So we've seen those sort of two clear signals that come probably as a result of lower oil prices. But again, if I just looked at total employment, total income, those big, big numbers, it would be hard to find.
Hard to find any signal of $30 a barrel oil right
now.
That's
correct.
And are you surprised that we're not seeing a bigger impact yet?
I am sort of surprised. I mean, it's you know, we are in sort of uncharted waters. You know, I forecast Anchorage, and last year I actually forecasted us to lose ground employment-wise, and we didn't. I was wrong. We actually ended up slightly positive in 2015. And as I said, we're forecasting again this year, and for statewide and for all the areas that we forecast for, we are forecasting some job loss, overall job loss. And that is tied to the price of oil. Most of those job losses that we're looking at that we think are going to occur are tied to state government in the oil industry and things tied to that industry.
And there have been, you know, turning to the oil and gas industry itself, there have been a few announcements of kind of high-profile layoffs,
right?
ConocoPhillips, BP. But overall, I mean, how is the industry doing?
Well, right now, if you look at the numbers right now, they still look, you know, relatively high from an historical perspective. But, you know, that could change. I mean, the biggest numbers out there in the oil sector are not the producers, are not the BPs and the Conocos, but it's really the service companies that are the bigger players, the drillers, the service companies like Halliburton or Doyon Services or, you know, those kinds of things. And so we're waiting to see what happens there. And you're less likely to get a public announcement from that side of the industry. That's more likely to occur, although I think eventually we will hear about it, and we do get their numbers, so eventually that will be calculated in our monthly employment statistics.
And, you know, how is Alaska different than, say, North Dakota, where you've seen companies going bankrupt, where you've seen big layoffs, where you've seen rigs come out of the ground? I mean, it seems like our oil industry just operates differently. We can't bust as fast just because we aren't built that way.
Yeah, and I think part of it may be that, and that's going to be answered in the next year or two. You know, we appear to be more a project-based. You know, when you undertake a project in Alaska, it's usually a pretty big one. So if you're in the middle of it or a third of the way through, you're not going to just probably quit. On the other hand, if you're in a place where you can just punch lots of holes in the ground, drive a truck somewhere on a road and punch holes, you can end that activity as well much more quickly. So it's much easier to shut things down, I think, in many of those places.
State labor economist Neil Fried speaking with APRN's Rachel Waldholtz. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Juneau artist weaves her first Chilkat blanket.
So we've got the raven teaching the eagle, teaching the raven, teaching the raven. So it's a linear Juneau, honoring our teachers.
Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, supporting Alaska's workforce and operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
Happy New Year! Start the year off right by filing your 2016 PFD application. Don't forget to sign your application electronically or by printing a signature page. The deadline to apply is Thursday, March 31st, 2016. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
The East Coast is still digging out from this weekend's blizzard. In Washington, the side streets of Capitol Hill look suitable for running the Iditarod, but the U.S. Senate did meet this morning for 10 minutes, and that included an unhurried opening prayer from the Senate chaplain.
Lord, the paralyzing snow reminds us that to everything there is a season, a time for every matter and purpose under heaven.
Senator Lisa Murkowski was one of two senators to show up. She said she couldn't help notice that both of them, herself and Senator Susan Collins of Maine, are female. So was just about everyone else in the chamber, like the clerks and the parliamentarians who ensure the rules are followed. Even the Senate pages on duty, Murkowski said, were an all-female team.
Perhaps it just speaks to the hardiness of women that put on your boots and put your hat on and get out, slog through the mess that is out there. I don't know about you all, but I spent a good portion of my weekend shoveling. I feel stronger today.
On Facebook, Murkowski posted a photo of her shoveled brick walkway leading to a snowy Washington street. Murkowski says many people have asked if these are just normal conditions for an Alaskan.
In fact, we got as much snowfall here in the D.C. metropolitan area as Anchorage, my hometown, has had accumulated over the course of this season.
Little business got accomplished in the Senate today. Murkowski moved to postpone consideration of her energy bill until tomorrow, when more senators might be present. A controversial proposal to increase minimum school enrollment in the state seems unlikely to pass this legislative session if such a bill even materializes. KDLG's Hannah Calton reports.
This fall, Republican Representative Lynn Gaddis of Wasilla said she wanted to increase the threshold number of students from its current 10 to 20 or 25, a move that would cut state funding to more than 50 small schools statewide. The proposal met with strong resistance from rural schools and superintendents, and that opposition seems to have carried over into the legislature. Anchorage Democratic Representative Les Guerra says while it's still early in the session, he doesn't think the bill has enough support to get signed into law.
There are a number of Republicans I've spoken to who oppose it. Every Democrat in the legislature I've spoken to opposes it. And if it passes, and the governor vetoes it, I think there are Democratic and Republican votes to sustain a governor's veto. The question then becomes whether the governor vetoes the bill, and I think he would.
and the issue may not even come to a vote. Representative Gaddis has not filed a bill, but said Thursday she was glad to see her proposal had set off a statewide discussion about public education funding.
I don't have a bill. I want to assure folks that some of these smaller schools, certainly was not my intention, but I have gotten the attention that I wanted. And that attention is, folks, we got to start doing things differently. We have to start looking, and we all collectively, be it school districts, be it parents, we all have to come together and say there have got to be different ways that we do deliver this great education.
In October, Gaddis said that raising the school enrollment threshold to 20 would save the state about $7 million. That's less than 1% of the state's $1.2 billion education budget. The idea triggered a social media campaign with the hashtag #SmallSchoolsMatter, which now has more than 3,700 supporters on Facebook. In Dillingham, I'm Hannah Colton.
17 cars were stolen in a single 24-hour period in Anchorage starting Monday and running through this morning.
A majority of them were cases or scenarios where the motorist had left their key in the ignition running so that it could warm up.
Jennifer Castro is a spokesperson for the Anchorage Police Department. She says 16 stolen cars is an exceptionally high spike, but part of a phenomenon the department is used to seeing. More cars are stolen when the temperature fluctuates back and forth around freezing. The oscillations cause more frost on vehicles, leading residents to idle them unattended for longer, which Castro says creates an opportunity for theft.
We actually sent out a similar press release like this around the same time last year.
Castro says the reports came in from neighborhoods all across Anchorage and that most thefts involve the short-term use of a car or truck.
A lot of people ask, why are people stealing cars or what are they using them for? And a lot of the times it's for a temporary situation. They just want to use it to get from point A to point B. It's often that when we do recover these vehicles, there's drug paraphernalia and things like that found in them.
It's against municipal code to leave a vehicle idling unattended without an auto start or keyless operating system.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the 2016 statewide BP Teachers of Excellence program. Teacher nomination forms are available at bpteachers.com.
Artists make us think and question. They excite and engage. Artists inspire Alaska. The 2016 Rasmussen Foundation Individual Artist Awards Grant Program is now accepting applications. Individual Artist Awards support Alaska artists in 10 creative disciplines at all career stages. The program is open to Alaska residents only. For details and to apply, visit rasmussen.org/IAA. The deadline is March 1st, 2016. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
The Portland Art Museum in Oregon has commissioned a Tlingit Chilkat robe from a Juneau weaver, adding a fourth generation to a lineage of weaving students and teachers. KTOO's Elizabeth Jenkins visited a shop downtown where one woman is trying to find the time to weave her first Chilkat blanket.
Let's see. The pattern itself will start, and I'll put in some black here. And we'll
Lily hopes it's in front of a 5-foot-long wooden loom carved by her father. It's the second week of a year-long project, but the Chilkat robe is already taking shape. Chunky stripes of black and yellow.
Right now, I am traveling from right to left.
Hope weaves across the loom, a motion she describes as jumping jacks for her fingers. And she says this is the first time in years she's had regular hours away from her kids.
I don't know about other moms who have gone back to work, but it's pretty emotionally challenging. And then it's ultimately gratifying, satisfying to be here to weave, but it's a constant opportunity cost of, like, what am I giving up to be able to weave and what am I giving up to stay home?
Hope says Chilkat blankets are one of the most prestigious ceremonial dance robes. The warp, which kind of looks like yarn, hangs free, vertically on the loom. The warp is made of merino wool, twined with strips of cedar. At the bottom, strings are clumped together in a row of tiny socks. Actually, Hope's kid socks. And her own, from when she was a kid.
I love having all the generations, you know, sitting here or hanging out with us, little feet hanging out.
When Hope was about 6 years old, she remembers her mother learned to weave from Ginny Clanott.
I don't know if you've ever been to an elderly Native household, but it smelled like seal oil or it smelled like fibers. And if I could go back in time and smell that again, I know that it would be, you know, that would be so vivid in my mind.
Her mom tried to teach her. But as a teen, she says she thought it was dull. Then in her 20s, she picked up Raven's Tale weaving and later Chilcat.
It was interesting to return to it and feel that similar, like, time passing, but not to be bored by it.
The Portland Art Museum has Chilcat robes from three generations of weavers, including Hope's mom, Clarissa Rizal. Museum curator Dina Dart says the blankets will be part of a traveling exhibit. It's called The Art of Resilience, The Continuum of Tlingit Art.
In showing the continuum in this big exhibition, it made sense to me to commission a robe by one of Clarissa's students, right, and to extend that genealogy to a fourth generation.
That fourth generation being Hope. Dart thinks no other museum in the country has a lineage of Chilcat robes like this. But she says the blankets don't just belong to the museum. They belong to the tribes, too. That's why the museum loans the items for ceremonies.
One of the things that we're really working on here at the Portland Art Museum is having those important objects be a part of the living culture.
Dart says she'd like to see Hope and her mom's robe dance together someday. Back at the loom, Hope's finishing up the border on the Chilcat robe. Soon she'll start the process of weaving Tlingit moieties in the design.
So we've got the raven teaching the eagle, teaching the raven, teaching the raven. So it's a lineage robe, honoring our teachers.
Hope isn't posting photos on Facebook or Instagram of her progress with the weaving. She's keeping with tradition. The blanket won't be seen by the masses until it's finished. Hope says she doesn't weave when she's angry. And when she's at the loom, she only weaves with a feeling of gratitude.
How lucky am I to sit here in front of this piece in this ancient art form to have my hands in this warp and just be like, wow, it's a little overwhelming and kind of leaks into the rest of my life to have like gratitude to be able to do this, but gratitude to go home and see my kids.
She says at first she was afraid to spend the 1,000 hours it takes to weave the Chilcat blanket alone.
What do you do with yourself all day with your thoughts? And it hasn't scared me as much as I thought it would. It's not that scary.
The Chilcat robes will travel with the Art of Resilience around the country next year, then possibly to Paris and back to Juneau in 2019 for a 10,000 square foot exhibition. In Juneau, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins.
The technique of bronze casting goes back thousands of years, but it has found a recent foothold in Alaska. Sculptor Pat Garley, a former contractor, has switched to art for his livelihood, and he is now populating Alaska's buildings and parks with his metal designs. Garley is one of the recipients of the 2016 Governor's Awards for the Arts and Humanities. The studio is a cavernous warehouse behind a tiny frame cottage on a rural Palmer Street. Pat Garley, wearing a beard, Carhartts, and heavy work boots, looks like a typical Alaskan, except for the diamond in his earlobe. He's leaning close, too close, I think, to a sturdy furnace on the floor, which is blasting enough heat to melt metal. That's exactly what he's intending to do.
What I'm doing is I'm loading in bronze into the furnace while it's running. As it melts down and makes room, then I continue to add bronze. But what I have to do is I have to preheat it all before I drop it into the crucible. You cannot drop cold metal into a hot crucible.
What happens if you do?
Well, if it has any moisture on it and it gets below the surface of the metal, you get a steam explosion. That's bad.
That's dangerous.
Yeah,
you're not
like
wearing a mask.
No, because I'm being careful.
He's melting down pieces of a griffin design that didn't work out. It's the ultimate recycle. There's no waste here, as bits of a bronze wing disappear into a crucible set into the searing red glow inside the furnace. He says when the crucible is full, he'll let the molten metal cook for a while longer.
And we're going to wait until that metal gets up to a temperature of 2,100 degrees.
What is it now, do you know?
Right now it's probably 1,500. It's around 1,800, the bronze starts to melt.
Garley is using an ancient technique known as the lost wax process. He says it's a method of casting bronze that hasn't changed much since 3,500 BC.
If somebody came today and from that time and saw what I was doing, they would know what I was doing.
The ancients didn't have the advantage of a natural gas-powered furnace, though. Garley's two-story warehouse looks like something out of a homesteader's dream. Shelves cluttered with old but usable items, bicycles, truck tires, hoses, tools of all kinds line three walls. The fourth side is all about bronze casting, dominated by primitive wax models and silicon and rubber molds that litter a long table.
Blacksmiths meet here. We hold classes here.
And the studio doubles as a regular meeting place for area artists.
We hold classes sometimes in sculpture. Sometimes we hold them in casting.
Garley's Sculpture Works is the only foundry in Alaska, and that's a benefit for other sculptors who are spared the big expense of shipping to foundries outside to have their work cast in metal.
Yeah, I'm just finishing up the clay original right now.
Justin Sperlin drops by, and he brings a lifelike clay bust he'll eventually cast in bronze.
3D full bust.
What do you mean 3D?
Full round.
Okay. Oh, okay.
In the bronze casting process, a wax duplicate of a design is made first, then a ceramic shell is molded around the wax. The hard mold is fired in a kiln. The wax melts out through vents installed in the mold, leaving behind a hollow cavity, a sort of inside-out duplicate of the original design, called a negative. Justin's bust is awaiting a little more work to make it even more lifelike. In clay, it shows minute details of hair and skin and facial expression.
You can see the hair in the eyebrows. Mm-hmm. You can see the wave in a guy's hair. You can see the crow's feet around his eyes and his mouth. How do you get those tiny details in? Are they,
well,
how does that...
it's up to the artist to put them in. This is Justin's bust, but all those details, to get him in the bronze, you got to put them in the original. And then what we do, the whole goal in bronze is to capture all those details through this process and then reproduce it in bronze.
Garley's own designs can be seen at the Palmer Museum and at the Alaska Sea Life Center in Seward. He'll next tackle a commission from the Matsu Borough, a life-size image of Joe Reddington. The Reddington bronze will be in addition to the borough's newest school when the statue is finished. Pat Garley will receive the governor's honor on January 28th in Juneau. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Josh Edge, Rachel Waldholtz, and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Hannah Colton in Dillingham, and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Gokey is our web editor. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence.
And by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. At the Salmon Project, they know that Alaskan lives are salmon lives. Join them this winter as they journey across the state and hear the stories of Alaskans whose lives are amazingly similar to yours, even if they live 2,000 miles away. Learn more at salmonlife.org. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project. Alaska Pacific University delivers a distinctive educational adventure designed to support your personal and professional goals. Through generous APU scholarship packages and the new APU Promise Tuition Grant Program, APU is a sound educational investment in your future. Apply today at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.